outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Well, Kyle, you notice anything different?
About?
Me.
I mean, you're not wearing a golf polo.
Okay. The not wearing is a key, but it's not the golf polo. I no longer have on my back brace.
Oh.
Did you not notice this? My gosh. I know it looked like I've been wearing suspenders for the last 3 months.
Well, and often it's down lower, so I can sometimes see the top of it, but
it goes over my shoulders, dude.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
Were you wearing it the last?
Yeah.
You were wearing it the last time we were recording, did you?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I must be blind. I must be blind as a bat or just not observant.
I had my follow-up appointment with my surgeon, my 3.5 month follow-up.
Yep. With your back surgeon.
And everything's great. Everything's looking good. Couldn't be more pleased. He said it's time to go without the back brace and let those muscles begin to support itself, which he said you'll be sore for a couple of days. I'm surprisingly sore. Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah, I didn't think it was all that much. I thought the brace was more just to hold things together. It was actually holding things up. So now my muscles have to do it. And I start physical therapy next week. So things are really changing in Jacobson world. Because physical therapy is the part of surgery I probably hate the most. And it's probably the most valuable. But man, I just stupid little exercises repeated over and over again drive me nuts. Especially since they don't help you lose any weight. They're not those kinds of exercises.
Okay, so on that vein, though, will you get to swing a golf club in the semi-near future?
No.
Really?
He said, it'll be at least 6 months from surgery before you... And he said, you start by just putting and chipping. Then you kind of work up to the clubs and be able to play. So I'm probably a good 9 to 9 months out from actually playing golf again.
Okay.
If I pick it up again. Not sure I will.
Really?
Yeah. I've enjoyed it less, honestly, in the last 5-6 years. I lost some guys I used to play golf with early morning, fun kind of golf. And now I'm playing with a group of guys who play for money, very serious, takes 5.5 hours to play a round of golf or six instead of the requisite 2.75 hours if you tee off first light. And so it just takes a big hunk of the day, usually driving somewhere to play a long ways away. And it's kind of a whole day out of my life. And I've really enjoyed it less. But my grandson's picking it up. And so I probably will get back to enough of it to play with him. So yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not sure I'm going back to the old, we got $45 riding on this putt. So we're going to line it up from 75 different angles and try and figure it out.
Oh my gosh.
It's just, and they're sticklers about the rules. Every rule. I mean, I like guys playing for fun. Hey, you hit a bad shot, you're in the woods, take a mulligan. Who cares? Let's just play. We're playing for fun. We're not competing. But when you play for money, you compete. So, kind of tired about that. The other good news at chemotherapy last week, they used the R word for the first time, remission. And not that I'm there. They said, you're on the verge of it. Your numbers are crouching right up against it.
Wow.
And hopefully in the next couple of weeks. But they already did cut down one of my infusion treatments from every week to every other week. So
that is incredibly good news.
It like is that. Good news. It's been a crazy 3.5 months. I have learned so much. I'm telling you, just can't believe some of the things that it triggered in my life and opened doors has opened and conversations Jesus and I have had to work through this. But yeah, I'm really grateful. It looks like there's some, maybe a little bit of light at the end of this tunnel. And it's not the big light. It's not the big one.
The big beckoning light.
That'll eventually come, but not yet.
Mm.
Wow. I'm grateful for that. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. We finally got through the move and our house is actually settled. That I can't say that about my shop and my storage shed, but that's okay.
Those are second place items.
Absolutely. And my shop is still functional, so that's a good thing. And no, it's been good. We have just been transitioning back into the new semester. And I love this semester because I teach a lot of practical counseling classes this semester where we're really getting into the nuts and bolts of what is it like to sit with another person and what does it look like to read nonverbal cues and be able to ask good questions. And what does it look like to be an active listener that genuinely cares about what your client is saying versus just waiting on the edge of your chair for them to stop talking so that you can stop, you can talk. Especially with this current generation. So a lot of my 18 to 25 year olds, it gets really interesting when, because one of the sections that we do is on eye contact and silence. So they have to just sit and they can't say a word. They have to sit with their hands in their lap and they have to just look at each other and see how long they can go without breaking eye contact. And, oh my gosh, it is hilarious watching the level of discomfort that rocks through the bodies of these poor Gen Zers is hilarious.
Well, you like torturing them. This is the generation that has a 4.3 second attention span, thanks to TikTok. Correct. Or something.
Yeah.
They're going to stare deep into the eyes of another person and not say anything. Nobody's talking, either one.
Neither one of them are talking. Yeah. And it's just sitting and observing and making eye contact. And oh my word. I mean, it only lasts, between 10 to 30 seconds at most. And then they're all like fidgeting and turning and spinning in their chairs. And
I was going to say, what's the real world application of this? When would you ever sit down and just stare in somebody else's eyes, both of you? I mean, I can understand doing it while they're talking and listening and being present. I don't understand where I would ever sit down with Sarah and we just stare in each other's eyes and nobody's talking.
Well, especially for doing marital counseling, it actually is very intimate. It can actually build a lot of trust and connection between two people. But the heart behind this is opening just the idea of what it's like to sit in the chair for a client. And then from there, we transition into the conversation about the power of silence. And so a lot of young therapists think that they need to fill any pause they can with any words or, basically to remove the discomfort with language. Right. And often you can actually use the power of silence to hold space for people and really honor what they're going through. But it's a skill. You really have to learn it. It's not an easy thing to do, to be able to sit quietly, especially if somebody is having a deep emotional experience. Often, especially young therapists, their own discomfort with sitting in the room with them causes them to break the client out of that moment and often out of the healing. Yeah. And so that's where we kind of introduce that conversation.
I've seen that a lot in fellowship groups where some people just can't stand a silence and they're constantly filling it. And in that context, when you're constantly filling the silence just because you're uncomfortable, you're keeping the really good things from happening. And people that would be not by the pressure of the awkward silence, but simply thinking deep enough to be able to have the space to offer the thoughts or questions they might have. And usually there's people, and I certainly would volunteer to say, I was one of those when I was much younger, of if there's silence in a Bible study group, something is wrong, I must fill it. I'd be one of those things. Yeah, I did that tons. But I've learned in the last 20 years that the more space there is for the person who's more deeply thinking to talk, the better off it is than the person that's just filling silence because they're uncomfortable with it.
I also think there's a piece too of being intentional to learn how to check in with your own heart and say, Lord, what's going on here? Like what would you say in this situation? Where are you at in this? Really looking for his signature or his fingerprint in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And if your own angst is just trying to mitigate the discomfort or trying to cover over the silences, you can't hear that. You can't connect with, okay, Lord, what would you have me say in this moment? Or would you have me just sit with them and say, I don't have any words, but I will hold this with you and see where that goes. I mean, it just, so often we miss people and we miss people's hearts because of our own personal discomfort in the room.
Yeah. And there's people who really like that to happen. Just somebody keep talking so I don't have to.
Yes. Yes.
So it's not always a negative for some people, but I think it's a negative for better conversation if there's not. And it may be that somebody who's talkative has something good to say. I'm not saying they won't. But if you're feeling silence just to feel silence because it makes you feel awkward, then you'll keep other people from having the opportunity to open up and share where their hearts are.
I think back to our conversation last week about the foundation of experiencing God's love and him telling you, I love you. and knowing that you are loved, if we are constantly talking, how does he get a word in? How do we get to actually pause and experience him engaging with us if we're just constantly saying something and they're like, okay, I said what I said, now peace out, thank you God, like conversation over, amen, you know?
It's like, yes.
Well, that was epically one-sided.
So. Especially because God isn't one of those who fills silences quickly.
No, he does not.
he takes him a while to figure out how he's going to enter the conversation or how we're going to let him or whatever. I think the pauses and the whole waiting on God thing is just a real powerful part of that connection, which brings me to the best thing I heard this week.
Ooh, okay.
But before that, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And this is The God Journey. Yeah, I read this in the New York Times. Somebody sent me this. It's from December 19th, so it's a while back, but I just read it this week. It's an article called The Shock of Faith. It's Nothing Like I Thought It Would Be by David Brooks. And so New York Times is pretty amazing, but he said this, the desire for God appears to be insatiable. Nobody ever said, I once experienced God's presence, and that was enough for me. I'm good. Now that it got me, honestly, as simplistic as that is, it got me really thinking about, I have never come away from a connection with God that I felt I wasted my time. Now, I have with movies, I have with sports entertainment shows, I've with others, I've got with golf rounds. I walked away going, well, that was a waste of 6.5 hours because I didn't play well and the conversation wasn't good and it was just a mess anyway. But to really think, have I ever come away from an engagement with God where I went, yeah, that's good, I think I'm good for another 10, 12 days or whatever. It's like there is an insatiability to that hunger to know him. And I think the frustration when there are periods of time when you don't connect, when you give it time, when you give it place, but you feel like you're all alone in this engagement. I get where people kind of get worn out on that and go, so I'm too busy to find my way back to that moment because I don't want to be disappointed again. But when the engagement actually happens, when God makes himself known, there's nothing about that that's like, yeah, okay, good. Yeah, I'm full.
Well, and I've seen, especially for you in our over the last couple of years, one of the things that I've really seen that resonate with is your prayer group, right? And the agreeing with God prayer group and how like you think of prayer group and you just cringe because like, okay, it's a bunch of people going through the rotation of praying their demands. And then it's like, okay, well, I guess we're over, you know, kind of a thing. Instead of that waiting on him and allowing that treasure to unfold as different people are having different insights or nudges or pieces of the picture. I haven't ever heard you say, oh, this is, I'm done with this. I'm good. I'll see you guys later for in a year or two. I haven't ever heard that feedback from those spaces there. And conversations.
And 2 weeks is just about right. I'm telling you, you know, if it was every week, I think it's okay. It's time for that again. But every other week, by the time it rolls around, it's like, oh, I can't wait. Tomorrow, I get to connect with those guys again and ladies. And yeah, it has been that because it has been an engagement. Mm-hmm. Now, the bigger test of that, which we just talked about this last week with that group, when do we know when to quit? Mm-hmm. You know, you can milk this thing because now the relationships are so good among each other that it could devolve into just a fellowship group. We just get together and everybody's wanting to talk about, you know, my health and someone else's business thing or some. There's so much going on with everybody in the room that we could take, you know, sometimes do, unfortunately, we take like 45 minutes just checking in with each other and catching up on each other and going, you know, I'm really not praying here because we just got excited about that part of it. And so some things, I think that's why whatever we do in terms of spiritual things, we tend to do forever. We tend to, you know, and I've referred this before, but what Paul and Barnabas say, they completed the work God gave them to do. Jesus says the same thing in the high priestly prayer of John 17. Sarah and I read it last night of, I've completed the work you gave me to do with the people you gave me to do it with. And it's a wonderful thing. I've had moments like that where you say, okay, that's done. This podcast, we're crouching up on 1,000th episode. And I'm going, no, we can't do it forever. My gosh, I never thought we'd get to 500. Now we're almost at 1,000. When do we ever say about something wonderful, we've completed that work, it's time to go on? I think two things. One, the people in this thing keep changing, so that helps the new conversations emerge. The other thing is we get email from people who, I mean, there's some people that have listened to God Journey since the beginning, and I just still in shock. But the other people found us a week ago.
Yeah.
Just like, I love what you guys are doing. Please don't stop whenever we talk about stopping. So I guess God will make it clear when the time's up, but it's hard to give up something that's nurturing and life-giving.
It is. And often I feel like, how many times does a movement or a connection or an experience with Father along those lines where it is very nurturing, it is very empowering, it really resonates with our heart in a deep way, how often do we try to keep that going in a forceful way where it's like, okay, we're going to structure this, we're going to put some curriculum around this, we're going to, you know, put some leadership around this, and then we're going to keep it moving forward, we're going to keep it alive, and then all of a sudden you're just kind of camping on the flavor of what was from yesterday, but it's just kind of a dull hint instead of the actual rich tasting of the presence of God.
Yeah, my friend Kevin Smith from Australia used to say tradition is trying to get God to do again something he did once. And that's what I hear in that kind of thing. When it gets to be a copy of itself, and we're really good at that. Humanity's really good at, oh, that was fun. Let's do it again. Let's put all the same factors in play and let's hope it, you know, let's hope it happens. And if it's not happening, let's pretend it's happening. We're really good at all that. Instead of, I think the difference here is, as long as this is life-giving and real and nurturing and there's something new in it, then yeah, let's keep rolling. And when that ends, and there may come a time where we'll just have to say, hey, you know, that is it. It's ends. And there may be some other people God wants me to pray with, and other folks in that group can find folks to pray with and see how we grow that kind of thing or expand it.
Yeah.
But man, dare not take the copy of that and go back over the journal and say, okay, week one, we did this, week two, we did this, and now we've got a formula. And now it's lifeless, but we've got to pretend it's not lifeless because we're investing a lot of time in it. And now we've gone down the same road every other religious institution or tradition has gone down. So what about you? Something you heard this week?
Yeah. One of my weird things is I listen to an audiobook every night in order to be able to sleep. And I have been.
Don't tell me I put you to sleep every night. Some book I'm reading just bore you to death.
Yes, your melodious tone makes me pass out every night.
Perfect. I love hearing that.
I have to be kind of careful with the books that I listen to now when I'm sleeping, because it makes its way into my dreams and can kind of mess some things up if I'm not careful with what I'm listening to. And so in general, I often listen to Chronicles of Narnia because I have them, all of them. So all the books are in one set. So it's like 15 hours long is this audiobook. And I was listening to The Magician's Nephew the other night, and this quote blasted in, like came through my headphones, and I like sat up and was like, oh, I need to rewind that. That was really good. I need to take note of that. And the quote was, "O Adam's sons, how cleverly you defend yourselves against all that might do you good." O Adam's sons, how cleverly you defend yourselves against all that might do you good. That caught my attention of, oof, like how cleverly do we defend ourselves against the work and life of Christ and call it self-protection or call it health or call it wholeheartedness. And yet it doesn't have that flavor of life, you know, especially a lot of those old ways of getting through life that we use in order to survive. And yet there's no life in them. And yet we have to pretend like they're still functioning mildly to help us out. And yet we're being called, the whispers are calling us into something different.
Especially when the thing God's using to get deep in our hearts. I think of Paul, he had the messenger from Satan buffeting him, and he said, I entreated the Lord three times to get rid of this. And he said, my power is perfected in weakness. I'm not going to take this away from you. And I think about when this disease started, and at least my awareness of the disease started, and sitting in an emergency room, finding out I have cancer and I have a broken vertebrae or decomposed vertebrae in my back. My first thought was, I've got to resist this. Oh God, please. Oh God, heal. Oh God, this. Oh God, that. And in time, it became more apparent that this wasn't something God was going to save me from. This was something he was going to walk through with me. And that's easy to say. It's kind of trite when you say it. That was probably 3 weeks of being in some kind of place with God going, what are we doing here? Obviously, this is not something you have for me. Disease is a bad thing. And I wouldn't say God gave it to me at all. I would never posit that. But just part of the chaos of creation and broken creation, that disease found its way in my body. Well, I know 3-4 other people that have exactly the same disease, close friends that I care about and have cared about while they've had that disease. And I can see how much resisting it in the first 2 or 3 weeks, one, didn't do any good. Two, it kept me from learning inside of it what it is that God wanted me to know. Again, he didn't give me the disease to get there, but now that the disease is here, there's things he wants me to know. And then chemo treatments, trying to get healed. My gosh, who wants to go get shot in the stomach every week? And yet all of those things, I look back now, the resistance was pretty strong in those first 2-3 weeks. And then after that, I was, okay, this is what I'm going through. God can heal it anytime he wants, but this is what I'm going through. And if he's healing it with medicine, that's fine with me. Although it's more painful than if he just kind of snapped his little magic wand and things were better. But that's immediately what I thought of when you said that, how easily we resist the things that God wants to take advantage of. That's a good way to say it, probably, in my life. Yeah, we do. We guard ourselves against the very things that God wants to use to put his life into us and to help us be more focused and to change something about our heart. And that's all been part of this for me.
So how has that been unfolding over the last few months? As you've been navigating your own, I mean, a collision with your own mortality, the unknown of like, am I going to live through this? Am I not going to live through this? The impact on your relationship with you and Sarah, like what's been unfolding for you in the midst of that as God's been walking with you through it and the two of you have been unpacking this together, what has been coming out of that?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say that when this thing started, I was embarrassed to have cancer. And not that I wanted to hide it from anybody, but just, I thought I was, this is going to sound horrible and it needs to, because it is horrible. I thought I was above this, which, what does that say about my friends who have it?
Yeah.
That they weren't above it, that they, you know, somehow, and I there's a whole lot that God untangled in my heart in those early days about being embarrassed. Cause I had a need like that. Somehow I thought, cancer doesn't run in my family. Cancer is never anything I've ever thought of. Like that would be a thing for me to deal with. And yet you see the statistics and how many people get cancer of some kind in their lifetime. And just thinking that was never going to happen to me. And then when it did, there's a part of that just really had to get comfortable with the fact that things didn't go the way I wanted, that people could look at this and say, see, you're cursed. And that's what I thought of. Now, I've never felt that way about others, not to that degree.
Yeah.
But I've always felt like something must be, that got through, something must be wrong there. Not wrong, but just maybe they're not. You know, I don't know. It never comes to any conclusion.
Yeah.
But I noticed that I kind of looked down on it.
Hmm.
And God's been untangling that in a wonderful way of just realizing, hey, this is all happening to all of us. This is our need is our need, not just mine. And how it is that we crawl into that with other people. So that's been really a deal for me. I was surprised that I was embarrassed by it. And then I was embarrassed that I was embarrassed by it. And then God and I have just worked. Does that make sense?
It does. I guess I would love a little more clarity on what you mean by looking down on it. Because what do you mean you looked down on, like, I'm above this? What did you mean by that? Like, I'm just really curious about that. Like,
it's kind of hard to describe because you don't want to, it's not anything you formulated thoughts about. It was just perceptive feelings. But when I hear people have this kind of need and then they've got to go to chemo and they've got to do those kind of things, is maybe there's something lacking in their faith. Mm. That's horrible to say. I would never say that out loud.
Yeah.
Except I just did. I would never say it out loud because it doesn't interpret that way. But looking back, that's exactly what it was. And that really helped me to step back and go, wow, I really have, whether somebody's in poverty, whether someone's got a physical need, physical need that doesn't get healed, whether. And it just seems bizarre that, and it was over that more than, I mean, I've got a toe I was going to have surgery on as well.
Yeah.
That I've had to put off now because the back was more important. And I didn't feel bad about that. There was nothing embarrassing about that to me because that just, that got injured doing something, I don't know what, but I broke my big toe somewhere being a knucklehead, dropping something on it most likely. And so it sounds horrible to say I look down on people because I didn't feel that way. Mm-hmm. But my own embarrassment kind of helped me see that, that I had kind of put people. And it's not that I didn't feel compassion for them. That's why it's weird to talk about, because I felt compassion. Yeah. Oh my gosh, you've got this, whatever. But I was the embarrassment I felt for myself kind of gave me a sign that all was not well in Wayneland, which I've never thought it was anyway. But it gave me another place to grow in.
So I'm intrigued by this because there was an interesting dialogue that you and I talked a little bit about. And part of that dialogue was, I'm also getting all of this inspiration. I'm doing these books. I'm loving this process that I'm in. I'm loving these new dialogues that I'm having. And God, you can't take me because these are not finished yet. And that sentiment. And I remember you saying that and thinking like, okay. And yet how many, like, was Mozart writing a piece of music when he died? Like, was it like, and I was just reflecting on that. I was like, huh? Well, Lord, I agree that you have given my good friend a lot more things to say, but does that determine how long we have here on this earth? Or will some of that, because I'm guessing that if you were given another 100 years, you'd still have a lot to say and a lot of things that we were unfolding and curiosities and things that you were unpacking. So what are your thoughts on that?
I would hope so. I would hope the day I die, I'm still having things I'd love to think about.
Yeah.
I think these projects have felt like very specific things I need to get done. Yeah. So it's not just having thoughts and having ideas, but I wouldn't mind dying in the middle of a book. I didn't get it done. The fun for me is working on it. The fun for me is getting it onto a page. It's not necessarily having it distributed. So if people don't read the last book, it's fine with me. So this was much more specific to that. And I think someday, because the last 3 years have been kind of crazy because I went through the thing with Sarah. We got back to just loving her well. And that became my reason for living. If I never wrote again, I was going to be fine. Yeah. And then God, some inspirational inside began to put me down the road of some other projects. And as I talk about them with people are going, yeah, this is really important. I think you ought to probably do that. And so now it's back to a twofold thing. I'm writing when I have time, and I'm still trying to make Sarah's life as full as it can be, however I play into that with her. And so there's kind of a two-pronged thing. The travel thing, I'll be honest, I've really missed the travel. I've missed it for 3 years, just going and hanging out for a weekend with a group of people somewhere and exploring their journeys. And as we talked a couple of weeks ago, the inspiration I get, the things that I've discovered, I often discover in conversations with people. And sometimes when I'm saying something to them, because they posed a question a certain way, and when I'm answering it, I'm going, I've never heard that before, but I like that. Yeah. And I've missed that. And I haven't had a lot for the last 3.5 months because I haven't been able to get out until now. Now I can be able to get out and do some things. But the fellowship I would have is people would have to come here.
Yeah.
And not a lot of people make room in their busy life. Other than the first visit, you know, let's go see Wayne and you're doing with cancer. Blah, blah, blah. And after that, they get back to their lives and they forget. Unless you're the one really creating the fellowship opportunities, they don't happen easily.
No, they don't.
I haven't been. So it's been mostly Sarah and me and a computer. I have conversations on Zoom with people. But it's that more Zoom always seems to put an agenda to it, or it seems to say we're doing this for a purpose, and casual conversation, just, you know, watching a football game or having dinner together. And then just things come up that are also beautiful, But I have had some, I guess I have had some discovery. I look back over the last 3 months, I had some conversations that have really opened doors to my heart. The travel ones, I think, were the ones that just, you meet strangers, you meet somebody you've never met before, and they have a hunger or a question or struggle, and just helping them opens doors in my heart to things. And I miss that. I have missed that a lot over the last 3 years, other than when we're in the RV together, just hanging out with people, we're doing a lot of driving and other stuff. But boy, when we're sitting down and talking to people, either at restaurants or in small groups in parks or whatever, I am fueled by those things. And I've just thought in the last few days, I've really missed that. And I don't know how God, I don't know what the next season is of God providing that for me.
It'll be interesting to see what that'll look like as that unfolds for you. Cause I know that that has been a huge part of your life and something that has really been a fuel for your thoughts, inspiration, even a lot of the conversation here on the God Journey.
Yeah.
And even like you and I starting to host some retreats there for a little bit and exploring that and seeing what that kind of looked like. And, you know, even dabbling in some of those things. And then stuff happened with Sarah and that shifted and life just changed for a period of time. And it's just intriguing. It'll be really intriguing to see how that continues to unfold or what kind of inspiration God might have.
It will be. I had the first invitation I've had in a while. I think most people know I'm not traveling, but somebody who doesn't know any of that just recently found some of the books and just said, there's a group of us here in Tennessee that would love to know if you could meet with us. And I just said, I'm not traveling right now. And here's some of the reasons, but it made me, I think that's what triggered that hunger going, I haven't done that in a while. Cause I don't know anybody here. It would be showing up. I think one couple we've met previously came to Nashville one time when I was there and going, yeah, I'd miss that. To get off a plane, have no idea what you're going to get into, whether it's going to be good or bad, whether it's a cult of some kind or some really genuinely hungry people. Yeah. Maybe we get back to that. Maybe that's time. Maybe I've completed the work there God gave me to do, which would be fine too.
So what happened when the need shifted? I'm curious. So you talked a little bit about the need and the care, and especially when all of a sudden all this is going on, you got this incredible back pain. What happened in your conversations with you and Sarah when you'd been caring for her heart and really pursuing her for a significant period of time as she'd been really navigating the trauma and the unfolding of that and the counseling and that whole experience? What was it like when the need shifted for you?
It was uncomfortable for sure. I think the first year Sarah and I were finding our way back together and she was dealing with the major elements of her trauma. There was a real caring for her heart thing that I felt very demonstratively. And I think in the second year, it had become far more mutual. It had become far more Sarah and I sharing this journey together. And it wasn't just about her need. It was about our life together. And she's always good at caring for me. And so when this kind of cut in on it, it kind of flipped it back to where Sarah's the caretaker. And I can't even dress myself, shower myself. I can't do anything in the early days of recovering from this. So it became Sarah doing everything for me. And Sarah overextended in every way. And I couldn't save her from it. It's just one of those seasons of time where, you know what, we got to lock in here and do this. And we got to get through this until Wayne's well enough to begin to pick up some of this stuff on his own. And so now we're kind of getting, I think we're getting back to that mutuality thing in the last few weeks. It's not so much Sarah caretaking, although she does a lot anyway to take care of my life. But now we're in this together. Her journey's continuing. My journey's continuing. She's really supportive and excited about some of the things I'm working on, writing on, because she gets read to when I've got something that's almost ready to be done.
Yeah.
And she loves that. So I think we're back to some of that more mutual space now. But in the early days, it was just, we were both overwhelmed and I couldn't do anything. I just couldn't do anything to kind of help save her from what she had to do to take care of me. And boy, did I want to. So there's a lot of frustration. That was one of my best arguments for God healing me was that Sarah needs me. And so take care of all this, get it gone. So I don't.
Man, I remember in the first year and a half that Jess and I were married, I was in graduate school and about to graduate, studying for my finals, and had a very complicated ruptured appendix that resulted me being in on bed rest for 3.5 weeks and a bunch of wound care and all this stuff. And it was so humbling to have my new bride be taking care of me at that level of vulnerability, and me and my male stubbornness, or just my Kyle stubbornness. I was like, oh no, I'm going to still have some independence here. And so I remember I went in and I was going to take a shower by myself. I didn't need her to help with the wound care and that kind of thing. I've got this. And I get into the shower and I start and I go to do my wound care and I fainted.
In the shower. Oh my God.
On the floor in the shower, because it was not a very comfortable process to do that wound care, to say the least. And oh my gosh, it was just that receiving love when I wasn't able to give back, when I wasn't able to do back, and yet just to be there and to receive that love and to allow that to serve and care for my heart. That was hard. That was very disruptive for me and still is, but that, like, I remember that, especially early marriage, that was incredibly
disruptive. Yeah, I think early marriage, you'd feel like, oh my gosh, I've become a liability and we haven't even gotten started yet. My word. Yeah, so you're responsible for Elle's appendicitis, huh?
Yes, I passed on that little genetic gem to her. Yes, that was me. I
remember being in the hospital with our son. He was 14, 15, have his appendix out, and the doctors turned and said, okay, which one of you gave it to him? And we went, what? Said, who's not got an appendix? It's Sarah. I still have mine, as far as I know. So somebody had a part of this. But yeah, I think it is an important part of being human, to be able to help and share help when you can share it, and to receive help when you need help. And yeah. I think that's one of those embarrassing things. I go back to that little bit of embarrassment about I need to care for something, which is a bad thing. I need to be the one that's further down and well enough to care for someone else. And it's there's room for both in a real human journey. You can't have one without the other, I don't think.
I honestly think it is a very loving and grace-filled reset when, especially if you are used to, like, both you and I live lives where we give a lot to others around us. And there's a lot of our life focus is on helping other people connect with a more wholehearted experience. Yep. And so to be in that bend of life giving, that bend of whether it's career or work or whatever that might be, it's a hard reset when, especially for me, when I've been doing that for a while and then all of a sudden a major need comes up and I have to start asking for help. It's been in those moments where I've really seen God's love and care and honestly his intervention to say, no, you've been giving long enough. Let me remind you what it means to receive love without you being able to do anything. It's always humbling, but it's always been just a really healthy reset of, no, this is a mutual thing. This goes back and forth. This is a community thing, not just a you thing.
Yeah, and just when you're laying there or sitting in a chair and you're out of drinking water and there's no way you can go to the fridge and back by yourself and having to ask, could you please get me a drink of water, which is just the simplest thing. And Sarah never minded. Sarah's never expressed one element of frustration about it, but it just felt so unfair. It just felt, I want to get my own. Thank you very much.
Man, yes. And that's an interesting piece. That's an interesting piece to this whole process that, I remember when Eliana was going through her appendix thing, it would have been
a year ago.
We would have just been getting back. Just a week ago, we would have been getting back to Sheridan, and this time last year, and just the incredible community that God brought around us and did for the next year. I mean, 2024 was very much God bringing people in around Jess for a season of time, people bringing God or God bringing people around me for a season of time, him healing Eliana, and just the incredible process that was. I mean, it seemed like one day after another, one event after another, it was a lot of asking for help or asking for care. And it was so rich, Wayne. Like I remember just being in tears, humbled by the incredible love of community and relationship, and just being like, man, that honestly being humbled a little bit more and being like, I should probably ask for help on a more regular basis. That A, it would be a good just practice of humility. Yeah. But I think honestly, it's one of those Adam's son, how cleverly you defend yourself against all that might be good, might do you good. It's good for me to ask people for help. It's good for me to put myself in a posture and a place to say, I don't do this alone. I'm not lone rangering this. This is a vulnerability of mine. What does it look like to have that cared for?
But there's a real difference too, isn't there, between, you know, asking for help from somebody on the outside and their willingness to say, yeah, I'd be happy to, I'll come in, blah, 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 versus the spouse that's kind of trapped with the need.
Yes.
That's where I feel it, you know, and it's not that Sarah ever expressed anything other than her joy in caring for what I was going through, but it was different in the sense that she doesn't have an option other than walking out the door. Bye-bye, you're done. But when somebody else comes over, just because they know you're hungering for fellowship and they've got the time and they come over and they sit down, spend a couple of hours with you, and you know, they didn't have to do that. There was no constraint on them. There's a bit of a constraint on the marriage vow and the marriage commitment, and for sickness and in health, they're going to care for each other. And yet Sarah does that so well. And I've done it with her hip surgeries and shoulder surgeries. She's had her share of stuff as well, but it's different when people have the option not to.
But did you feel the constraint? Like for you, when you needed to care for Sarah?
I didn't feel constrained. Yeah, I didn't feel constrained from my side.
Okay.
But I do feel that for the other person when it feels like that. And they may not feel it at all. I don't know about that. This will be an interesting conversation with Sarah, which I'm sure we'll get into when we listen to the podcast together. But because I don't feel it. I feel like it's my joy to help with her. And she probably would feel the same way.
And see, I think that's the piece right there. Because I remember getting called out by a good friend of mine. I was talking about being able to provide emotional support for another person and how I love to be able to give or to be generous in that regard or to walk alongside of things with people. And their response was, and how often do you allow people to do that for you? And it was a like hard pause. And they're like, Kyle, you're robbing people of the gift that you just got done talking about for the last 20 minutes. That me not being vulnerable, me not asking for that help, me like the same thing, like I feel constrained, you know, for the other person, right? If I'm asking them for help or if I'm opening that vulnerability to them, I feel like I am constraining them and the tension or the pressure that I can put on them. And yet how often when somebody gives me an invitation to care or serve them, does that delight my heart? And I don't know. It's a tough conversation. It's not an easy one.
If we had time and we don't, simply because we're out of it. But this is what Paul's getting at when he said, God perfects himself in our weakness. Yeah. I will boast in my weakness because when I'm weak, then I'm strong. And I think that going back to the embarrassment I felt, suddenly I was on the weak end of things.
Yes.
And not in a great way. Now I'm a different place. I can be inside that weakness and going, I need help here. I can't do that. And we negotiate along. But that's what Paul said was a key lesson in his life. That it says, so he said, I will delight in insults and persecutions. I'll delight because when I am weak, then he is strong. And somehow we've gotten that off, and I wish we had more time. Maybe we'll talk about it next week. But we get this whole thing turned around. I think, it's my strength that God wants.
Yes.
Maybe it's your weakness.
Yeah, I think we need to circle back to that next week.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.